Chapter 13. One of the most momentous events in human history took place at a time that will probably never be known, for reasons that can only be guessed at, by means that seem barely credible. I refer, of course, to the peopling of Australia. Until fairly recently, accounting for the presence of human beings in Australia was not such a problem. At the beginning of the century, it was thought that Aborigines had been on the continent for no more than 400 years. As recently as the 1960s, the time frame was estimated to be perhaps 8,000 years. Then in 1969, a geologist named Jim Bowler from the Australian National University in Canberra was poking around on the shores of a long, dried lake bed called Mungo in a parched and lonely corner of western New South Wales when something caught his eye. It was the skeleton of a woman obtruding slightly from a sandbank. The bones were collected and sent off for carbon dating. When the report came back, it showed that the woman had died 23,000 years ago, at a stroke almost tripling the known period of occupation in Australia. Since then, other finds have pushed the date back further. Today, the evidence points to an arrival date of at least 45,000 years ago, but probably more like 60,000. The first occupants of Australia could not have walked there, because at no point in human times has Australia not been an island. They could not have arisen independently, because Australia has no ape-like creatures from which humans could have descended. The first arrivals could only have come by sea, presumably from Timor in the Indonesian archipelago, and here is where the problems arise. In order to put Homo sapiens in Australia, you must accept that at a point in time so remote that it precedes the known rise of behaviorally modern humans, there lived in southern Asia a people sufficiently advanced that they were fishing inshore waters from boats of some sort, rafts, presumably. Never mind that the archaeological record shows no one else on Earth doing this for another 30,000 years. We've got to get these people waterborne. Next, we have to explain what led them to cross at least 60 miles of open sea to reach a land they could not know was there. The scenario that is invariably invoked is of a simple fishing raft, probably little more than a floating platform, accidentally carried out to sea, probably in one of the sudden squalls that are characteristic of this part of the world. This craft then drifted helplessly for some days before washing up on a beach in northern Australia. So far, so good. The question that naturally arises, but is very seldom asked, is how you get breeding stock out of this. If it's a lone fisherman who's carried off to Australia, then clearly he must find his way back to his homeland to report his discovery, and to persuade enough people to come with him to start a colony. This suggests, of course, the possession of nautical skills sufficient to shuttle back and forth between invisible landmasses, a prowess few prehistorians are willing to grant. If, on the other hand, the trip was one way and accidental, then it must necessarily have involved a community of people of both sexes, swept out to sea, either all together on a large raft, thought very unlikely, or in a flotilla of small rafts, and that after successfully weathering a storm and at least a few days at sea, they were washed up on proximate parts of the North Australian coast, where they regrouped and established a society. You don't need vast numbers of people to populate Australia. Joseph Birdsall, an American academic, calculated that a group of 25 founding colonists could have produced a society of 300,000 in a little over 2,000 years. But you still need to get those initial 25 people there, more than could be plausibly accounted for with a raft or two blown off course. Of course, all this may have happened in any number of other ways, and it may have taken generations to get fully underway. No one can possibly say. All that is certain is that Australia's indigenous peoples are there because their distant ancestors crossed at least 60 miles of fairly formidable sea tens of thousands of years before anyone else on Earth dreamed of such an endeavor and did it in sufficient numbers to begin to start the colonization of a continent. By any measure, this is a staggeringly momentous accomplishment. And how much note does it get? Well, ask yourself, when was the last time you read anything about it? When was the last time in any context concerning human dispersal and the rise of civilizations that you saw even a passing mention of the role of Aborigines? They are the planet's invisible people. A big part of the problem is that for most of us it is nearly impossible to grasp what an extraordinary span of time we are considering here. Assume, for the sake of argument, that the Aborigines arrived 60,000 years ago. That is the figure used by Roger Lewin in Principles of Evolution, a standard text. On that scale, the total period of European occupation of Australia represents about 0.3% of the total. In other words, for the first 99.7% of its inhabited history, Aborigines had Australia to themselves. They have been there an almost unimaginably long time. And here lies their other unappreciated achievement. The arrival in Australia of the Aborigines is, of course, merely the start of the story. They also mastered the continent. They spread over it with amazing swiftness and developed strategies and patterns of behavior to exploit or accommodate every extreme of the landscape, from the wettest rainforests to the driest deserts. No people on earth have lived in more environments with greater success for longer. It is generally accepted that the Aborigines have the oldest continuously maintained culture in the world. It is thought by some, the respected prehistorian John Mulvaney, for instance, that the Australian language family may be the world's oldest. Their art and stories and systems of beliefs are indubitably among the oldest on earth. These are obviously important and singular achievements, too. They provide incontestable evidence that the early Aboriginal peoples spoke and cooperated and employed advanced technological and organizational skills at a time much earlier than anyone had ever supposed. And how much notice do these achievements get? Well, again, until recently, virtually none. I had this brought home to me with a certain unexpected forcefulness when, after leaving Allan and Carmel and flying to Sydney, I went for an afternoon to the State Library of New South Wales. There, while browsing for something else altogether, I came across a 1972 edition of the LaRousse Encyclopedia of Archaeology. Curious to see what it had to say about the findings at Lake Mungo 3 years earlier, I took it down to have a look. It didn't mention the Mungo findings. In fact, the book contained just one reference to Australia's Aborigines, a sentence that said, "The Aborigines also evolved independently of the Old World, but they represent a very primitive technical and economic phase." That was it, the entire discussion of Australia's indigenous culture by a scholarly volume of weight and authority written in the last third of the 20th century. When I say these are the world's invisible people, believe me, these are the world's invisible people. And the real tragedy is that that is only the half of it. From the first moment of contact, the natives were a source of the deepest wonder to the Europeans. When James Cook and his men sailed into Botany Bay, they were astonished that most of the Aborigines they saw, sitting on the shore or fishing in the shallows from frail bark canoes, seemed hardly to notice them. They scarce lifted their eyes from their employment, as Joseph Banks recorded. The creaking Endeavour was clearly the largest and most extraordinary structure that could ever have come before them, yet most of the natives merely glanced up and looked at it as if at a passing cloud and returned to their tasks. They seemed not to perceive the world in the way of other people. No Aboriginal language, for instance, had any words for yesterday or tomorrow, extraordinary omissions in any culture. They had no chiefs or governing councils, wore no clothes, built no houses or other permanent structures, sowed no crops, herded no animals, made no pottery, possessed almost no sense of property. Yet they devoted disproportionate efforts to enterprises that no one even now can understand. All around the coast of Australia, the early explorers found huge shell mounds, up to 30 feet high, and covering at the base as much as half an acre. Often these were some distance inland and uphill. The Aborigines clearly had made some effort to convey the shells from the beach to the mounds. One midden was estimated to contain 33,000 cubic meters of shells, and they kept it up for an enormously long time, at least 800 years in one case. Why did they bother? No one knows. In almost every way, it was as if they answered to some different laws. A few Europeans, Watkin Tench and James Cook notably, viewed the Aborigines sympathetically. In the Endeavour Journal, Cook wrote, "They may appear to some to be the most wretched people on earth, but in reality they are far happier than we Europeans. They live in a tranquility which is not disturbed by the inequality of condition. The earth and the sea of their own accord furnish them with all things necessary for life. They seem to set no value upon anything we gave them, nor would they ever part with anything of their own. Elsewhere, he added with a touch of poignancy, all they seemed to want was for us to be gone. Unfortunately, few others were so enlightened. For most Europeans, the Aborigines were simply something that was in the way, one of the natural hazards, as the scientist and natural historian Tim Flannery has described it. It helped to regard them as essentially subhuman, a view that persisted well into the 20th century. As recently as the early 1960s, as John Pilger notes, Queensland schools were using a textbook that likened Aborigines to feral jungle creatures. When they weren't subhuman, they were simply inconsequential. In the same period, a professor Stephen Roberts produced a fat and scholarly tome entitled A History of Australian Land Settlement, which managed to survey the entire period of European occupation and displacement without mentioning the Aborigines once. Such was the marginalization of the native peoples that until 1967 the federal government did not even include them in national censuses, did not, in other words, count them as people. Largely for these reasons, no one knows how many Aborigines were in Australia when Britons first settled it. The best estimates suggest that at the beginning of occupation, the Aboriginal population was about 300,000, though possibly as high as 1 million. What is certain is that in the first century of settlement, those numbers fell catastrophically. By the end of the 19th century, the number of Aborigines was probably no more than 50 or 60,000. Most of this decline, it must be said, was inadvertent. Aborigines had almost no resistance to European diseases. Smallpox, pleurisy, syphilis, even chickenpox, and the milder forms of influenza often cut swathes through the native populations. But where Aborigines remained, they were sometimes treated in the most heartless and wanton manner. In Taming the Great Southland, William J. Lyons details examples of the most appalling cruelty by settlers towards the natives, of Aborigines butchered for dog food, of an Aboriginal woman forced to watch her husband killed, then made to wear his decapitated head around her neck, of another chased up a tree and tormented from below with rifle shots. Every time a bullet hit, Lyons reports, she pulled leaves off the tree and thrust them into her wounds, till at last she fell lifeless to the ground. What is perhaps most shocking is how casually so much of this was done, and at all levels of society. In an 1839 history of Tasmania, written by a visitor named Melville, the author relates how he went out one day with a respectable young gentleman to hunt kangaroos. As they rounded a bend, the young gentleman spied a form crouched in hiding behind a fallen tree. Stepping over to investigate, and finding it only to be a native, the appalled Melville wrote, the gentleman lifted the muzzle to the native's breast and shot him dead on the spot. Such behavior was virtually never treated as a crime, indeed was sometimes officially countenanced. In 1805, the acting judge advocate for New South Wales, the most senior judicial figure in the land, declared that Aborigines had not the discipline or mental capacity for courtroom proceedings. Rather than plague the courts with their grievances, settlers were instructed to track down the offending natives and inflict such punishment as they may merit, as open an invitation to genocide as can be found in English law. 15 years later, our old friend Lachlan Macquarie authorized soldiers in the Hawkesbury region to shoot any group of Aborigines greater than 6 in number, even if unarmed and entirely innocent of purpose, even if the number included women and children. Sometimes, under the pretense of compassion, Aborigines were offered food that had been dosed with poison. Pilger quotes a mid-19th century government report from Queensland. The niggers were given something really startling to keep them quiet. The rations contained about as much strychnine as anything, and not one of the mob escaped. By mob, he meant about 100 unarmed men, women, and children. The wonder of all this is that the scale of native murders was not far greater. In the first century and a half of British occupation, the number of Aborigines intentionally killed by whites, including in self-defense, during pitched battles, and in other rather more justifiable circumstances, is thought to be about 20,000 altogether. An unhappy total, to be sure, but much less than one-tenth the number of Aborigines who died from disease. That isn't to say that violence wasn't casual or widespread. It was. And it was against this background, in June 1838, that a dozen men on horseback set off from the farm of one Henry Danger, looking for the people who had stolen or driven off some of their livestock. At Mile Creek, they happened on an encampment of Aborigines who were known among the white settlers of the district as peaceable and inoffensive. Almost certainly they had nothing to do with the rustled cattle. Nonetheless, their captors tied them together in a kind of great ball, 28 men, women, and children, led them around the countryside for some hours in an indecisive manner, then abruptly and mercilessly slaughtered them with rifles and swords. In the normal course of things, that would almost certainly have been that. But in 1838, the mood of the nation was changing. Australia was becoming an increasingly urbanized society, and city dwellers were beginning to express revulsion for the casual slaughter of innocent people. When a campaigning Sydney journalist named Edward Smith Hall got hold of the story and began to bray for blood and justice, Governor George Gipps ordered the perpetrators tracked down and brought to trial. When arrested, two of the accused protested, with evident sincerity, that they hadn't known killing Aborigines was illegal. Despite clearly damning evidence at the subsequent trial, it took a jury just 15 minutes to acquit the defendants. But Hall, Gipps, and the urban public were not lightly pacified, and a second trial was ordered. This time, seven of the men were found guilty and hanged. It was the first time that white people had been executed for the murder of Aborigines. The Mile Creek hangings didn't end the slaughter of Aborigines so much as drive them underground. They went on sporadically for almost another century. The last was in 1928, near present-day Alice Springs, when a white dingo hunter named Fred Brooks was murdered in uncertain circumstances, and at least 17, and perhaps as many as 70, Aborigines were chased down and killed by mounted constabulary in reprisal. A judge in that case declared that the police had acted within the law. But the Mile Creek case was undoubtedly a defining moment in Australian history. Though it gets at least a mention in almost all history books these days, I hadn't met anyone who had been there, or even knew quite where it was, and it seemed apparent from the descriptions I had read that the authors had drawn exclusively from historical sources. I wanted to have a look. It takes a little finding. From Maxville the next morning, I drove 60 miles up the Pacific Highway to Grafton, then headed inland on a steep and lonely road up and through the Great Dividing Range. 4 hours later, in hot and empty sheep country, I reached Dullungra, a gas station and a couple of houses with long views over mostly treeless plains, and there I turned down a back road that followed a twisting, sometimes nearly washed-out course on its way to the small town of Bingara, 25 miles to the south. A couple miles short of Bingara, I came to a small, rickety-looking bridge over a half-dry creek. A little sign announced it as Mile Creek. I pulled the car into the shade of a river gum and got out to have a look. There was no memorial, no historical plaque, nothing at all to indicate that here, or at least somewhere in the immediate vicinity, was where one of the most infamous events in Australian history took place. To one side of the bridge was a forlorn rest area, with a pair of broken picnic tables and a good deal of shattered bottles in the stubby grass around the edge. In the sunny middle distance, perhaps a mile away, stood a large farmhouse, surrounded by fields of unusually verdant crops. In the other direction, and much closer, an overgrown track led to a white building. I walked along it to see what it was. A sign announced it as the Mile Creek Memorial Hall. It wasn't much of a monument to a terrible slaughter, but at least it was something. Then on a wall of the building, I noticed a hand-painted sign and discovered that it had nothing to do with the slaughter. It was a memorial for the dead of two world wars. I drove on the last couple of miles into Bingara, population 1,363, a hot and listless village with a dozing main street. It looked like a place that had once known prosperity, but most of the storefronts now were either empty or taken up with government enterprises, a health clinic, an employment advice center, a tourist information office, police station, something called a senior citizens rest center. An old and improbably large movie house still announced itself as the Roxy, but clearly had been shut for years. In the tourist information center, I was received by a pleasant-looking middle-aged woman who bobbed to her feet at the sight of a customer. I asked her if they had any information about the massacre, and she gave me a crestfallen look. "I'm afraid I don't know much about that," she said. "Really?" I said, surprised. The place was full of leaflets and books. "Well, it was a long time ago. I believe the children study about it in school, but I'm afraid it's not something visitors ask about very often." "How often? Just out of interest." "Oh," she said, and clasped her chin as if that was a real poser. She turned to a colleague who was just emerging from a back room. "Mary, when was the last time someone asked about Mile Creek?" "Oh," said the colleague, equally stumped. "I couldn't say. No, wait. There was a man who asked about it maybe 2 months ago. I remember now. He had a little goatee. Looked a bit like Rolf Harris. I can't remember the last time before that." "Most visitors want to go fossicking," the first lady explained. "Fossicking is to hunt for precious minerals." "What do they find?" I asked. "Oh, lots. Gold, diamonds, sapphires. This used to be a big mining area." "But you have nothing at all on the massacre?" I asked. "I'm afraid not." She seemed genuinely regretful. "I tell you who can help you is Paulette Smith at The Advocate." "That's the local paper," added the colleague. "She knows all about the massacre. She did some kind of study on it for college. If anybody can help you, Paulette can." I thanked them and went off to find The Advocate. Bingara was an oddly interesting little town. It was small and half-dead and on a road to nowhere, yet it had not only a tourist office, but also its own newspaper. At The Advocate office, I was told that Paulette Smith had popped out and that I should try back in an hour. Slightly at a loss, I went into a cafe and ordered a sandwich and a coffee, and was mindlessly consuming both when a woman, red-haired, late 30-ish, and looking faintly breathless, abruptly slid onto the seat facing me. "I hear you're looking for me," she said. I smiled. "News travels fast here." She rolled her eyes ironically. "Small town." Paulette Smith was rather intense, but with a sudden disarming smile that would flash at odd moments, like a broken sign, and then be lost at once in the greater intensity of what she was telling me. "We didn't learn anything about the massacre when I was growing up," she said. "We knew it had happened, you know, that a long time ago some Aborigines were killed out by the creek, and that some white people were hanged for it. But that was about it. We weren't taught about it in school. We didn't, you know, make school trips out there or anything." The smile came and went. "Did people talk about it?" "No, never." I asked her where exactly it had happened. "Nobody knows," she said. "Somewhere on Mile Creek Station." Station in the context means a farm or ranch. "It's all private property now, and they're not real friendly to trespassers. It's owned by a businessman from Sydney as a kind of hobby farm. He's not, you might say, too interested in the historical connection." "So there's never been any kind of archaeological dig or anything? You don't get academics poking around?" "No, there's not that kind of interest in it. Anyway, I don't think they'd know where to look. It's a big property." "And there's no memorial of any kind?" I asked. "Oh, no." "Isn't that odd?" "No," she said. "But wouldn't you expect the government to put up something?" She considered for a moment. "Well, you've got to understand, there was nothing all that special about Mile Creek. Aborigines were slaughtered all over the place. 3 months before the Mile Massacre, 200 Aborigines were killed at Waterloo Creek, near Moree. Moree was 60 miles or so farther west. Nobody was ever punished for that. They didn't even try to punish anybody for that." "I didn't know that," I said. She nodded. "No reason why you should. Most people have never heard of it. All that was different about Mile Creek was that white people were punished for it. It didn't stop them killing Aborigines. It just made them more circumspect. You know, they didn't boast about it in the pub afterwards." Another flickering smile. "It's kind of ironic when you think about it. Mile Creek's not famous for what happened to the blacks here, but for what happened to the whites. Anyway, you wouldn't be able to move in this country for memorials if you tried to acknowledge them all." She stared dreamily for a moment at my notebook, then said abruptly, "I have to get back to work." She made an apologetic look. "I'm afraid I haven't been much help." "No, you've been a great help," I said. Then I thought of another question. "Are there any Aborigines here now?" "Oh, no," she said. "They're long gone from around here." I paid for my lunch and returned to the car. On the way out of town, I stopped again by the bridge and wandered a little way up an overgrown lane that led onto part of the station property. But there was nothing to see, and I was a little afraid of snakes in the tall grass. So I returned to the car and retraced my route across the dusty plain and on toward the distant blue slopes of the Great Dividing Range. And so to Surfer's Paradise, back on the Pacific Coast Highway and another 100 miles north. Surfer's Paradise is just over the border in Queensland, and I was eager to dip a toe into that interesting and erratic state. In a country where states are both few and immense, the arrival in a new one is always an event. I wasn't going to come this far and not at least slip over the border. One thing you find if you browse much through nonfiction works on Australia is that practically every book written about the country in the last 40 years, possibly more, has in it somewhere an anecdote illustrating that Queenslanders are not like other people. In Australian Paradox, Jean McKenzie relates the story of an American guest at a rural Queensland hotel in the 1950s who was presented at dinner with a plate of cold meat and potatoes. He stared with private disappointment at the offering for a moment, then diffidently inquired whether he might have a little salad with it. The waitress, Ms. McKenzie reports, looked at him with astonishment and disdain, and, turning to the other guests, remarked, "The bastard thinks it's Christmas." Here's another that I have read twice. A visitor, French in one version, English in the other, is staying at a Queensland hotel during the wet, the rainy season that is a feature of life in northern Australia. The guest is startled, upon reaching his room, to discover that it is flooded to a depth of 3 or 4 inches. When he reports this at the front desk, the owner looks at him with pain and irritation and says, "Well, the bed's dry, isn't it?" All these stories have certain things in common. Generally, they take place in the 1950s. Generally, they involve a foreign visitor at a rural hotel. Generally, they are presented as true, and always they make Queenslanders look like pricks. Most suggest that Queenslanders are just crazy, and the evidence does rather point in that direction. For almost 2 decades, the state was under the control of Joe Bjelke-Petersen, an eccentric right-wing state premier who at one time seriously entertained the notion of blowing up parts of the Great Barrier Reef with small atomic bombs to create shipping channels. Of late, it had gained fame as the seat of a politician named Pauline Hanson, a fish and chip shop owner who had started a right-wing anti-immigration party called One Nation, which had had a spell of striking success before it became evident even to her most ardent followers that Ms. Hanson was a little, shall we say, cerebrally singular. She wrote a book in which she suggested that Aborigines engaged in cannibalism and produced an interestingly paranoid video which began, "Fellow Australians, if you are seeing me now, it means I have been murdered." Her seat was the Brisbane suburb of Oxley, which inspired some genius to dub her the Oxley Moron. In a word, Queensland has a reputation for being a place apart. I couldn't wait to get there. In 1933, Elston, Queensland, was a remote and inconsequential seaside hamlet with an excellent beach, a few flimsy cottages, a popular but slightly raffish hotel, and a couple of shops. Then the town fathers got a really good idea. Realizing that nobody was going to travel hundreds of miles to visit a place called Elston, and more to the point, that nobody was traveling hundreds of miles to visit a place called Elston, they decided to give the place a peppier name, based on something novel and upbeat. Looking around, their gaze fell on the local hotel. It was called Surfer's Paradise. The sport had just become popular in Australia. The name had a certain ring. They decided to give it a try and see what happened. The town has never looked back. Today, Surfer's Paradise is famous, while its neighbouring resort communities, Broadbeach, Currumbin, Tuggan, Kira, Balinga, are scarcely known outside Queensland. It hardly matters, because they have all coalesced into a single unsightly sprawl, stretching for 30 miles from the Queensland-New South Wales border, almost to Brisbane. The whole is called the Gold Coast. This is Australia's Florida. You see it long before you get to it. shimmering towers of glass and concrete rising beside the sea and snaking off down the coastline to a distant, hazy vanishing point. When Jean McKenzie passed this way in 1959, not one bit of this glitziness existed. Surfer's Paradise was still a low-key, low-rise, old-fashioned sort of place. In 1962, it got its first high-rise. Another followed a year or two later, then another. By the end of the 60s, half a dozen 10- or 12-story buildings stood awkwardly and a little self-consciously along the front. Then in the early 1970s, a development frenzy started. Where once there were just sandy quarter-acre plots, each holding a matchbox beach cottage, today stand hotels of Trump-like splendor, balcony department towers, a domed casino, verdant golf courses, water parks, amusement parks, miniature golf courses, shopping malls, and all the rest. Much of this, you are told in a confidential tone, was built and paid for with money of dubious pedigree. People outside Queensland will tell you that the Gold Coast is rife with unsavory elements. Australian drug barons, Japanese yakuza, flashy linchpins of the Hong Kong triads. This is not, you are led to believe, a place to bump a Mercedes and start an argument. Nearly everyone you meet elsewhere in Australia will tell you, "Oh, you must see the Gold Coast. It's awful." "Really?" you say, intrigued. "In what way?" "I don't know exactly. I've never been there myself." "Well, obviously. But it's like, have you seen Muriel's Wedding?" "No," you reply. "Well, it's like that. Just like it, apparently." So I was interested on many levels to see the Gold Coast, and disappointed on nearly every one of them. To begin with, it wasn't tacky at all. It was just another large, impersonal, well-provisioned international resort. I could have been in Marbella or Eilat or any place else developed in the last 25 years. The hotels were mostly big international names: Marriott, Radisson, Mercure, and of an unexceptionably respectable standard. I parked the car on a side street and walked along to the seafront. En route, I passed stores of an unexpected glitziness: Prada, Hermes, Ralph Lauren. All perfectly fine, it just wasn't very interesting. I didn't need to travel 8,000 miles to look at Ralph Lauren bath towels. The beach, however, was exceedingly splendid. Broad, clean, sunny, with lazy, manageable-sized waves rolling in from an almost painfully blue and bright sea. The air was filled with salt tang and the ozone-enriched shrieks of pleasure and children shouting and a sense of people having fun. I took a seat on a bench and just watched people enjoying themselves. I had read somewhere that the Gold Coast beaches are actually quite treacherous for rips. As it happened, drownings were much in the news lately. Australian media cover beach mishaps the way American papers cover blizzards and hurricanes, as a seasonal event involving lots of comparative statistics. According to the papers, there had been 34 drownings already this year, more than most years, and the summer wasn't yet half over. Much of it was blamed on tourists who didn't know how to read the water for rips or to stay calm when they were caught in one. But a lot of it was just down to lunacy. The Sydney Morning Herald cited the case of a 52-year-old man at a place called North Avoca Beach who had sternly cautioned people not to swim at a particular spot, then went in himself and drowned. Just that morning, while packing up at my motel, I had paused to watch a lifeguard from here at Surfers Paradise being interviewed on a breakfast television program. He said that he himself had rescued 100 people the previous week, including one tourist whom he had saved twice. "Twice," said the interviewer. The lifeguard grinned at the ridiculousness of it. "Yip. What, you saved him and he went back in the water and you had to save him again?" The grin broadened. "Yip." I scanned the water for troubled swimmers. I couldn't imagine how any lifeguard could spot a drowning person among all the hundreds of happy, frolicking bodies, but they most assuredly do. Australian lifeguards are unquestionably the finest in the world. In the same period that 34 people drowned, more than 6,000 were saved, a commendable ratio to say the very least. Eventually I stopped for a cup of coffee and then wandered through the business district, but Surfer's Paradise was mostly just a succession of stores selling the same stuff: painted boomerangs and didgeridoos, cuddly toy koalas and kangaroos, postcards and souvenir books, rack upon rack of T-shirts. In one of the shops, I bought a postcard that showed a kangaroo surfing and asked the young lady who served me if she knew where the original Surfer's Paradise Hotel was. "Oh, I don't know," she said, and looked guilty, as if she had forgotten a secret with which she had been entrusted. "I haven't been in the area very long," she added. I nodded that it didn't matter and asked her where she was from. "ACT," she replied. Seeing my mind worrying to little effect, she added, "Australian Capital Territory, Canberra." "Of course." "So which is better," I asked, "Canberra or Surfer's Paradise?" "Oh, Surfer's by a mile." I raised an eyebrow. "It's that good, is it?" "Oh, no," she said emphatically, amazed that I had misread her. "Canberra's that bad." I smiled at her solemnity. She nodded with conviction. "I reckon if you were going to rank things for how much pleasure they give, you know, Canberra would come somewhere below breaking your arm." I grinned, and she grinned too. "Well, at least with a broken arm, you know it'll get better." She talked with the rising intonation common to young people in Australia, which turns every statement into a question. It drives older Australians crazy, but personally, I find it endearing and sometimes, as here, charmingly sexy. A supervisor-type person came over to make sure we weren't enjoying ourselves too much. "Can I be of assistance?" she said, in an odd accent that suggested long devotion to a book entitled Elocution Self-Taught. She held her head at an odd angle, too, tilted back slightly as if she were afraid that her eyeballs might fall out. I was looking for the original Surfer's Paradise Hotel. "Ah, that was torn down some years ago." She flashed a satisfied smile. It reminded me exactly of William F. Buckley. I'm not sure it wasn't William F. Buckley. Though whether the smile indicated that she was happy that it had been torn down, or merely pleased to be able to convey disappointing news, I couldn't say. She showed me on the map in my guidebook where it had stood. I thanked them both, and, clutching my directions, found my way to the site of the famous, and now irretrievably lost, Surfer's Paradise Hotel. Today the spot is occupied by a shopping complex called the Paradise Center, which was much more in keeping with the modern resort, in that it was ugly and filled with overpriced crap. In the Surfer's Paradise book I had consulted in Adelaide, a photograph from the late 1940s had shown a delightfully ramshackle hotel, a place that looked as if it had been built in phases with whatever materials had come to hand, with a terrace bar on which sat many people soaking up sunshine and alcohol in careless volumes and looking awfully pleased to be there. I walked all the way around the block, then stood on the opposite corner and stared at the site for a long time, but it wasn't possible to imagine it as it had been, any more than it was possible to imagine the Mile Creek Massacre from its present peaceful situation. So I returned to the car and headed out of town through the dappled stripes of sun and shade created by the big hotels and lavish palm trees. At the edge of town, I rejoined the Pacific Highway and headed south. I had a long drive to Sydney ahead of me. For the moment, my trip was over. But I would be back, of course. I wasn't anywhere near finished with this place yet. Part 3. Around the Edges. Chapter 14. "I just want you to know," said a voice in my ear, as Qantas Flight 406 popped cork-like out of a tower of monsoonal cumulonimbus, presenting the window passengers with a sudden view of emerald mountains rising almost sheer from a pewter sea, "that if it comes to it, you may have all my urine." I turned from the window to give this remark the attention it deserved, and found myself staring at the solemn and rested countenance of Alan Sherwin, my friend and temporary traveling companion. It would be incorrect to say that I was surprised to find him sitting beside me, because we had met in Sydney by design and boarded the flight together, but there was nonetheless a certain residual measure of unexpectedness, a kind of pinch-me quality, in finding him seated there. 10 days earlier in London, where I had stopped on my way back to America from my hike in the Middle East, I had met Alan to discuss some project he had in mind. He is a television producer by profession. We had become friends while working together on a series for British television over the previous couple of years. There, in a pub on the Old Brompton Road, I had told him of my experiences in Australia so far, and mentioned my plans on the next trip to tackle the formidable desert regions alone and at ground level. In order to deepen his admiration for me, I had told him some vivid stories of travelers who had come unstuck in the unforgiving interior. One of these had pertained to an expedition in the 1850s, led by a surveyor named Robert Austin, which grew so lost and short of water in the arid wastes beyond Mount Magnet in Western Australia that the members were reduced to drinking their own and their horses' urine. The story had affected him so powerfully that he had announced at once the intention to accompany me through the most perilous parts of the present trip, in the role of driver and scout. I had, of course, tried to dissuade him, if only for his own safety, but he would have none of it. Clearly the story was still much on his mind, judging by his kind offer to keep me in urine. "Thank you," I replied now. "That's very generous of you." He gave me a nod that had a touch of the regal about it. "It's what friends are for. And you may have as much of mine as I can spare." Another regal nod. The plan, to which he was now resolutely attached, was to accompany me first to northern Queensland, where we would relax for a day amid the fertile shoals of the Great Barrier Reef, before setting off in a suitably sturdy vehicle along a bumpy track for Cooktown, a semi-ghost town in the jungle some way north of Cairns. This warm-up adventure completed, we would fly on to Darwin in the Northern Territory, the top end, as it is fondly known to Australians, for the 1,000-mile drive through the scorched red centre to Alice Springs and mighty Uluru. Having assisted me through the worst of the perils, the heroic Mr. Sherwin would fly back to England from Alice and leave me to continue on through the western deserts on my own. It wasn't that he thought I would be ready for this by then, for he had no confidence whatever in my survival capabilities, but that 10 days was all he had to spare. For my part, I had no greater confidence in him, but I was glad of the company. "You know," I added reassuringly, "I don't suppose it will actually be necessary to drink urine on this trip. The infrastructure of the arid regions is much improved since the 1850s. I understand they have Coca-Cola now." "Still, the offer is there," he said, "and much appreciated, too." Another exchange of regal nods, and then I returned my gaze to the exotic verdure below our waggling wingtip. If you needed convincing that Australia is an exceptional part of the world, then tropical Queensland would be the place to come. Of the 500 or so sites on the planet that qualify for World Heritage status, that is, a site of global historical or biological significance, only 13 satisfy all 4 of UNESCO's criteria for listing. And of these special 13 places, 4, almost a third, are to be found in Australia. Moreover, 2 of these, the Great Barrier Reef and the wet tropics of Queensland, were right here. It is the only place in the world, I believe, where 2 such consummate environments adjoin. We were lucky to be there at all. They were having a terrible wet season in the north. Cyclone Rona had recently buzzsawed along the coast, causing $300 million of havoc, and lesser storms had been teasing the region for weeks, disrupting travel. Only the day before, all flights had been cancelled. It was evident from the dips and wobbles of our approach into Cairns that a lot of assertive weather was still about. The view as we came in was of palm trees, golf courses, seaside marinas, some big beachside hotels, and lots of red-roofed houses poking out of abundant foliage. Weather apart, it all looked very promising. It is remarkable now, when over 2 million people a year come to the Great Barrier Reef, and it is universally esteemed as a treasure, how long it took the tourism industry to discover it. In Rum Jungle, an account of a tour through northern Australia in the 1950s, the historian Alan Moorhead made venturing into northern Queensland sound like a journey to the headwaters of the Orinoco. Then, Cairns was a small, muggy coastal outpost hundreds of miles up a jungle road and occupied mostly by eccentric dropouts of a fugitive disposition. Today it is a bustling mini-metropolis of 60,000 inhabitants, indistinguishable from any community of similar size in Australia, except for the humidity that falls over you like a hot towel when you emerge from the airport terminal, and a certain hailed devotion to the tourist dollar. It has become a hugely popular stop-off point for backpackers and other young travelers, for whom it has a certain reputation for tropical liveliness. On this day, the whole was pressed under an oppressive weight of low grey skies, of the sort that threatened rain in volume at any moment. We took a cab into town through a long, unbecoming sprawl of motels, gas stations, and fast food places. Central Cairns was somewhat snugger, but it had the feel of a place that had been built only recently, in haste. Every second business offered reef cruises or snorkeling expeditions, and most of the rest sold T-shirts and postcards. We went first to pick up our rental car. Because I had been hiking in the Middle East, I had left the arrangements to a travel agent, and I was mildly surprised to find that the agent had plumped for an obscure local firm, Crocodile Car Hire, or something similarly improbable and unpromising, whose office was little more than a bare counter on a side street. The young man in charge had a certain chirpy cockiness that was ineffably irritating, but he dealt with the paperwork in a brisk and efficient manner, chattering throughout about the weather. It was the worst wet in 30 years, he told us proudly. Then he led us out to the sidewalk and presented us with our vehicle, an aged Commodore Holden station wagon that seemed to have a decided sag about the axles. "What's this?" I asked. He leaned toward me and said, as you might to a dementia sufferer, "It's your car." But I asked for a four-wheel drive. He sifted through his paperwork and carefully extracted a fax from the travel agent, which he passed to me. It showed a request for a large, standard, high-polluting car with automatic transmission, an American car, in other words, or the nearest local equivalent. I sighed and handed back the paper. "Well, do you have a four-wheel drive I can take instead?" I asked. "Nope, sorry, we only do town cars." "But we were going to drive up to Cape York." "Oh, you won't get up there in the wet, not even in a four-wheel drive, not at this time of year. They had 100 centimeters of rain at Cape Tribulation last week." I had no very clear idea what 100 centimeters was, but it was evident from his tone that it was considerable. "You won't get beyond Daintree in anything less than a helicopter," he added. I sighed again. "The road to Townsville's been cut off for 3 days," he added with yet more pride. I looked at him again. "Townsville is south of Cairns, in the opposite direction from Cape York." It appeared we were boxed in. "So where can we go?" I asked. He spread his hands in cheerful irony. "Anywhere you like in Greater Cairns." Alan looked at me in the happily brainless way of someone who doesn't realize disaster is afoot, irritating me further. "Well, can you point us the way to the Palm Cove Hotel?" I asked. "Certainly. You go back out past the airport to the Cook Highway and take the road north. It's about 20 kilometers up the coast." 20 kilometers, I sputtered. "I asked for a hotel in Cairns." He scratched his chin thoughtfully. "Well, it's sure not in Cairns." "But the road is open," I asked. "So far." "You mean it might flood?" "Always a possibility." "And if it floods, we're stuck in the middle of nowhere." He looked at me with a touch of pity. "Mister, you're already in the middle of nowhere." The point was inarguable. Cairns was 1,100 miles from Brisbane, its own state capital, and there was nothing in the other directions but ocean, jungle, and desert. "But Palm Cove's real nice," he added. "You'll like it." And he was right. Palm Cove was lovely, really quite astonishingly so. It was a purpose-built village inserted with some care into a stretch of tropical luxuriance beside a curving bay. On one side of a beachside road stood low-rise hotels and apartments, a few cottages and a scattering of bars, restaurants, and shops, all discreetly obscured by palms, spreading fronds, and flowering vines, and on the other was a palm-lined walk overlooking a smooth golden beach and the sea. Our hotel was, in everything but name, setting, and price, a motel, but it was friendly and overlooked the sea. We claimed our rooms, then went for a walk along the beach. A few other people were strolling over the sand, but no one was in the water, and for a very good reason. It was the height of the season for box jellyfish, also known in Queensland as marine stingers, or just stingers. By whatever name they go, these little bubbles of woe are not to be trifled with. From October to May, when the jellyfish come inshore to breed, they render the beaches of the tropics useless to humans. It is quite an extraordinary thought when you are standing there looking at it. Before us stood a sweep of bay as serene and inviting as you would find anywhere, and yet there was no environment on Earth more likely to offer instant death. "So you're telling me," said Alan, for whom all this was new, "that if I waded into the water now, I would die." "In the most wretched and abject agony known to man," I replied. "Jesus," he muttered. "And don't pick up any of the seashells," I added, stopping him from leaning over to pick up a seashell. I explained to him about cone shells, the venomous creatures that lurk inside some of the handsomest shells, waiting for a human hand to sink their vile pincers into. "Seashells will kill you," he said. "They've got lethal seashells here." "There are more things that will kill you up here than anywhere else in Australia, and that's saying a lot, believe me." I told him about the cassowary, the flightless, man-sized bird that lives in the rainforests, with a razor claw on each foot with which it can slice you open in a deft and appallingly expansive manner, and the green tree snakes that dangle from branches and so blend into the foliage that you don't see them until they are clamped onto a facial extremity. I mentioned also the small but fearsomely poisonous blue-ringed octopus, whose caress is instant death, and the elegant but irritable numray, which moves through the water like a flying carpet, discharging 220 volts of electricity into anything that troubles its progress, and the loathsome sluggish stonefish, so called because it is indistinguishable from a rock, but with the difference that it has 12 spikes on its back that are sharp enough to pierce the sole of a sneaker, injecting the hapless sufferer with a myotoxin bearing a molecular weight of 150,000. "And what does that mean, exactly?" Alan asked. "Pain beyond description, followed shortly by muscular paralysis, respiratory depression, cardiac palpitations, and a severe disinclination to boogie. You might similarly be discommoded by firefish, which are easier to spot but no less hurtful. There's even a jellyfish called the snotty." "You're making this all up," he said, but without conviction. "Oh, but I'm not." Then I told him about the dreaded saltwater crocodile, which lurks in tropical lagoons, estuaries, and even bays such as this one, leaping from the waters from time to time to snatch and devour unsuspecting passers-by. Just up the coast from where we now strolled, a woman named Beryl Ruck had been taken not so long before, in a startling manner. "Shall I tell you about it?" I offered. "No." "Well, one day," I went on, knowing that really he wanted to hear, "a group of locals at Daintree got together for a festive pre-Christmas barbie when some of them decided to go for a cooling dip in the Daintree River. The river was known to be the home of crocodiles, but none had ever attacked anybody locally. So several of the party scampered down to the water's edge, stripped to their underwear, and splashed in. Ms. Ruck apparently thought better of leaping in, so she merely stepped a foot or so into the water. As she stood there watching the happy frolicking, she idly leaned over and trailed a hand through the water. Just at that instant, the water split in a flash of movement, and poor Ms. Ruck was gone, never to be seen again. There was no sound, no scream," reported one witness. "It was so quick that if you had blinked an eye, you'd have missed the whole thing." That is what a crocodile attack is like, you see. Swift, unexpected, extremely irreversible. "And you're telling me there are crocodiles here in this water," Alan said. "Oh, I don't know whether there are or not," I replied, "but it's why I'm letting you walk on the inside." Just then, from the restive skies, there came a single startling crack of thunder. Abruptly, the wind kicked up, sending the palm trees dancing, and a few fat splats of rain fell. Then the skies opened in a warm but soaking downpour. We hied back to our hotel, where we took refuge under the veranda of the beachfront bar, ineffectually wrung out our steaming shirts, and watched the rain beat down with a tumultuous fury. There was nothing so dainty as raindrops in this. It was just a cubic mass of falling water, filling the world with a fearful pounding din. I had thought that growing up in the American Midwest, I was familiar with lively weather, but I am happy to concede that where the elements are concerned, Australia plays in a league of its own. I had never seen anything like it. "So let me get this straight," Alan was saying. "We can't go to Cooktown because we can't get through. We can't swim because the ocean's full of deadly jellyfish, and the road to Cairns might be cut off at any moment. That's about the size of it, I replied. He blew out thoughtfully. Might as well have a few beers, then. He went off to get some. I took a seat at a small table on the veranda and watched the rain pour down. One of the bar employees came and stood in the doorway. Worst wet in 30 years, he said. I nodded. What's the forecast? Same. I nodded bleakly. We were supposed to be going out to the Great Barrier Reef tomorrow. Oh, you've got no worries there. They don't cancel the reef tours unless it's a hurricane. People go out to the reef in this kind of weather? I asked. He nodded. The water in the bay was sloshing around like a bath into which a fat man had just jumped. Why? How much did you pay for your tickets? He asked. I had no idea. Everything had been booked as part of a package. But I had the tickets with me and pulled them out of my wallet. $145 each, I squeaked in miserly disbelief. He smiled. There you go. He went back in. A moment later, Alan reappeared with the beers, looking unusually dejected. There is a jellyfish called the snotty, he said in wonder. The barman told me. I gave him an apologetic smile. Told you. He stared for some minutes at the rain. On the table, someone had left a copy of the local paper, the Port Douglas and Mossman Gazette. Alan started to move it to get at the ashtray. Then something caught his eye. He read for a minute, with increasing absorption, then wordlessly passed the paper to me, tapping the article he wished me to see. It was a small story at the bottom of the front page, noting that the dengue fever epidemic in Port Douglas had slowed at last. The article noted that since the epidemic had started, 485 cases had been reported in the area. Although the pace was slowing, this was not grounds for complacency, a spokeswoman for the Tropical Public Health Unit warned. It's at the bottom of the page, he said, his eyes just a trifle wild. That's where we're going tomorrow, I noted with idle interest. Do you have any idea what a dengue epidemic would be like in Britain? People would be nailing boards over their windows. Ferries would have people hanging off the sides trying to get out of the country. The police would have to shoot people in the streets to restore order. Here they get 485 cases in a single community, and it's 2 bloody inches on the bottom of the page. Where have you brought me, Bryson? What kind of country is this? Oh, it's a wonderful country, Alan. Yeah, right. We split up to shower and change, then reconvened in the bar for an aperitif before dinner. As the rain showed no sign of easing, we decided to dine at the hotel. At dinner, Alan ordered red snapper. You've not heard of Ciguatera, then, I said casually. Of course I haven't bloody heard of it, he replied through clenched teeth. What now? It's nothing, I said. Of course it must be something, or you wouldn't have mentioned it. What is it? Am I sitting in it? Is it on my head? What? No, it's a kind of toxin endemic to tropical waters. It accumulates in certain fish, like red snapper, for instance. Well, especially red snapper, actually. He considered this with a kind of slow, catatonic nod. I think jet lag was kicking in. It can do terrible things to one's equilibrium. I'm sure there's nothing to worry about, I added reassuringly. I mean, if there was an outbreak, snapper wouldn't be on the menu, would it? Unless, of course. I stopped there. What? He said. Well, unless you were to be the first case. It has to start with somebody, after all. But hey, what are the chances of that? 1 in 100? 1 in 20? I want you to stop this right now, he said. Of course, I agreed at once. I'm sorry. Do you want to change your order? No. The symptoms include, but are not limited to, vomiting, severe muscle weakness, loss of motor control, paresthesia of the lips, general lassitude, myalgia, and paradoxical sensory disturbances. That is, feeling hot surfaces as cold, and vice versa. Death occurs in about 12% of cases. I'm telling you to stop it right now, Alan said. The waitress came with our drinks. This snapper, Alan said with forced casualness. It's all right, is it? Oh, yeah, it's beaut, she replied. I mean, it hasn't got... What is it, Bryson? Ciguatera. She gave us a befuddled look. No, it comes with chips and salad. We exchanged glances. Would I be right in assuming you're not from around here? I asked. Her puzzlement deepened. No, I'm from Tassie. Why? Just wondered. I whispered to Alan, she's from Tasmania. He leaned to me and whispered back. Yes, so? Their snapper are okay. Is it possible to change my order, love? Alan asked. She stared at him heavily for a moment, the way young people do when they realize they're being asked to take 20 steps they hadn't budgeted for, and with a martyred air went off to find out. A minute later she reported back that permission had been granted to change his order. Excellent, said Alan with sudden enthusiasm, perusing the menu anew. He considered the many alternative options. Do you do baked snotty? He asked distantly. She stared at him. Just joking, he said, seeming much chirpier. I'll have the sirloin and chips, he announced. Medium rare, please. He turned to me. No horrid diseases I should know about with regard to beef? Queensland beef palsy or anything like that? You should be fine with steak, I said. Steak it is, then. He handed her the menu. And easy on the ciguatera, he called after her. And keep the beers coming, he added further. We had a lovely meal, and afterward retired once more to the bar, where, through the foolish wonders of alcohol, we managed to acquire nearly all the symptoms that we had so recently been at pains to avoid. In the morning the rain had stopped, but the skies were dark and dirty, and the sea full of chop. Just looking at it made me feel faintly ill. I am not enamored of the ocean or anything within it, and the prospect of bouncing 38 nautical miles to a rain-shrouded reef to see the sort of darting fish I could view in comfort at any public aquarium, or indeed dental waiting room, was not enticing. According to the morning paper, a 2.3-meter swell was expected. I asked Alan, who once owned a sailboat and a captain's cap, and thus fancies himself an accomplished mariner, how big this was, and he lifted his eyebrows in the manner of one impressed. Oh, that's big, he said. This led him to tell me many happy anecdotes of being pitched about in terrifying seas, some of them involving boats not tied to a dock. As we sat there, one of the members of the staff breezed past. Cyclone coming, she said perkily. Today, I asked in what was becoming a customary bleat. Maybe. Our reef tour included pickup at our hotel and transfer by bus to the boat at Port Douglas, 20 miles up the coast. The bus drew up at 8:50, on time to the minute. As we climbed aboard, the driver was giving a rundown on marine stingers, with vivid descriptions of people who had failed to their cost to heed the warning signs. He assured us, however, there were no jellyfish on the reef. Unaccountably, he failed to mention reef sharks, boxfish, scorpionfish, stinging corals, sea snakes, or the fat and infamous grouper, a 900-pound monster that occasionally, through a combination of testiness and stupidity, chomps off a swimmer's arm, then remembers that it doesn't like the taste of human flesh. I can't tell you how pleased I was when we arrived at Port Douglas to find that the boat was huge, as big as an English Channel ferry, or very nearly, and sleekly new. I was also pleased, for their sake and mine, that none of the crew seemed to be manifesting any of the more obvious signs of dengue fever. As we lined up with other arriving coach passengers, I learned from a crew member that the ship held 450, and that 310 people were booked today. He also told me that the trip to the reef took 90 minutes, and that the sea should be relatively benign. It was 38 nautical miles to Agincourt Reef, where we would moor. This was, I noted with more than passing interest, the place where the American couple had gone missing. When we got aboard, they announced the free distribution of seasickness tablets to anyone who wanted. I was the first to the table. This is awfully thoughtful of you, I said as I swilled down a handful. Well, it's better than having people spewing up all over the shop, said the girl brightly, and it was hard to argue with that. The trip to the reef was smooth, as promised. What's more, the sun came out, albeit weakly, turning the water from a leaden gray to an approximation of cobalt. While Alan went off to the sun deck to see if there were any women with large breasts to look at, I settled down with my notes. Depending on which sources you consult, the Great Barrier Reef covers 280,000 square kilometers, or 344,000, or something in between. Stretches 1,200 miles from top to bottom, or 1,600. Is bigger than Kansas, or Italy, or the United Kingdom. Nobody can agree, really, on where the barrier reef begins and ends, though everyone agrees it's awfully big. Even by the shortest measure, it is equivalent in length to the west coast of the United States. And it is, of course, an immensely vital habitat, the oceanic equivalent of the Amazon rainforest. The Great Barrier Reef contains at least 1,500 species of fish, 400 types of coral, and 4,000 varieties of mollusks, but those are essentially just guesses. No one has ever attempted a comprehensive survey. Too big a job. Because it consists of some 3,000 separate reefs and over 600 islands, some people insist that it is not a single entity, and therefore cannot accurately be termed the largest living thing on Earth. That seems to me a little like saying that Los Angeles is not a city because it consists of lots of separate buildings. It hardly matters. It is fabulous. And it is all thanks to trillions of little coral polyps working with a dedicated and microscopic diligence over 18 million years, each adding a grain or two of thickness before expiring in a self-created silicate tomb. Hard not to be impressed. As the ship began to make the sort of slowing down noises that suggested imminent arrival, I went out on deck to join Alan. I had expected that we would be arriving at some kind of sandy atoll, possibly with a beach bar with a thatched roof. But in fact, there was nothing but open sea all around, and a long rough of gently breaking water, which I presumed indicated the sunken and unseen reef. In the middle of this scene sat an immense aluminum pontoon, 2 stories high and big enough to accommodate 400 day trippers. It brought to mind, if vaguely, an oil platform. This was to be our home for the next several hours. When the boat had docked, we all filed happily off. A loudspeaker outlined our many options. We could loll in the sun in deck chairs, or descend to an underwater viewing chamber, or grab snorkels and flippers for a swim, or board a semi-submersible ship for a tour of the reef in comfort. We went first on the semi-submersible, a vessel into which people could crowd into a viewing chamber below the waterline. Well, it was wonderful. No matter how much you read about the special nature of the barrier reef, nothing really prepares you for the sight of it. The pilot took us into a shimmery world of steep coral canyons and razor-edged defiles, fabulously colorful and teeming with schools of fish of incredible variety and size. Butterfly fish, damsel fish, angel fish, parrot fish, the gorgeously colorful harlequin tusk fish, tubular pipe fish. We saw giant clams and sea slugs and starfish, small forests of waving anemones, and the pleasingly large and dopey potato cod. It was, as I had expected, precisely like being at a public aquarium, except, of course, that this was entirely wild and natural. I was amazed, no doubt foolishly, by what a difference this made. As I looked out, a great turtle swam past, just a couple of yards from the window, and quite indifferent to us. Then, furtively poking about on the bottom, was a reef shark, only a couple of feet long, but capable of giving you a jolly good nip. It wasn't just the darting fish and other creatures, but the way the light filtered down from above, and the shape and texture and incredible variety of the coral itself. I was captivated beyond description. Back on the pontoon, Alan insisted we go at once for a swim. At one side of the pontoon, metal steps led into the water. At the top of the steps were large bins containing flippers, snorkels, and masks. We suited up and plopped in. I had assumed that we would be in a few feet of water, so I was taken aback, I'm putting this mildly, to discover that I was perhaps 60 feet above the bottom. I had never been in water this deep before, and it was unexpectedly unnerving, as unnerving as finding myself floating 60 feet in the air above solid ground. This panicky assessment took place over the course of perhaps 3 seconds. Then my mask and snorkel filled with water, and I started choking. Gasping peevishly, I dumped the water out and tried again, but almost immediately the mask filled again. I repeated the exercise 2 or 3 times more, but with the same result. Alan, meanwhile, was shooting about like Daryl Hannah in Splash. "For God's sake, Bryson, what are you doing?" he said. "You're 3 feet from the pontoon and you're drowning." "I am drowning," I replied. I caught a roll of wave full in the face and came out of it sputtering. "I'm a son of the soil," I gasped. "This is not my milieu." He clucked and disappeared. I dipped my head lightly under to see him shooting off like a torpedo in the direction of a colorful Maori wrasse, an angelfish the size of a sofa cushion, and was consumed once more with a bubbly dismay at all the clear, unimagined depth beneath me. There were big things down there, too, fish half as big as me and far more in their element than I was. Then my mask filled and I was sputtering again. Then another small rolling wave smacked me in the face. I must confess that I liked this even less, quite a good deal less, than I had expected to, and I hadn't expected to like it much. Interestingly, I later learned that this is quite a common reaction among inexperienced ocean swimmers. They get in the water, discover that they are way out of their comfort zone, quietly panic, and faint, a Japanese specialty apparently, or have a heart attack, a fat person's specialty. Now here's where the second interesting aspect comes in. Because snorkelers lie on the water with their arms and legs spread and their faces just under the surface, that is, in the posture known as the dead man's float, it isn't actually possible, or so I am told, to tell which people are snorkeling and which are dead. It's only when the whistle blows and everyone gets out except for one oddly inert and devoted soul that they know there will be one less for tea.